Welcome to Well-Versed, where we bring biblical principles of governance to governmental leaders and you. This is the Well-Versed podcast.
We have two special guests tonight, Samuel Green. Samuel, as rather than me introduce you, I'm going to actually have you, as you come on, give your biographical sketch, if you can, in the first 30 seconds or 1 minute, just kind of tell who you are, where you are, your schooling, and then Samuel's going to jump right into an important topic. Just in the last, I think, 2 days, I didn't actually read about it till today myself. The Supreme Court announced December the 1st, they're going to hear one of the most important cases. If you don't know about Dobbs versus Jackson, you need to know about it now. Because on December 1st, according to what they've announced, maybe announced it on Friday, or just the last few days, they're going to be taking up a case that could potentially reverse Roe v. Wade and stop the slaughter of preborn babies in this country. So we're going to have a report from Samuel, and then you're going to hear an incredible testimony from somebody who is, I'll just wait and let her tell the story later. Samuel, tell us a little bit about you, if you would, and then jump into this incredibly important topic, prepare our hearts how to pray for what's coming at the Supreme Court. Samuel Green.
Well, thank you so much, Pastor Garlow. It is great to be with you all today. I am so honored to be on this call because the topics I'll be addressing really do require a lot of intercession. And I know there are so many faithful intercessors on this call. Just as a little bit of background, I grew up in the California desert, was blessed to be homeschooled along with my four siblings by wonderful parents who actually took a tour of Israel with the Garlows, and it was a life-changing experience for them. They absolutely loved it. And got my undergraduate degree at UCLA in political science, my law degree from Pepperdine, and then had the pleasure of working at a variety of places, eventually going on to work at Alliance Defending Freedom, litigating cases relating to freedom of speech, religious liberty, and sanctity of life, and then founded my own nonprofit pro-life ministry called Reason for Life that is really focused largely on reaching churches and Christian schools and colleges and other Christian ministries with the biblical and scientific message about the sanctity of life in the womb. So I have two main topics to present this evening. The first is that monumental abortion-related case that Pastor Garlow was just talking about, which is currently before the United States Supreme Court. The case comes out of Mississippi, and most agree that this is the most important case on abortion and the sanctity of life in the womb that the Supreme Court has heard in nearly 30 years. And the second topic that is of great importance is presenting the biblical case for life to believers. So I'll turn first to the Supreme Court. Before we talk about the case that is currently before the Supreme Court, I think a little background may be helpful for everyone. So in 1973, the Supreme Court delivered its Roe versus Wade decision, announcing a constitutional right to abortion. Now, if you read the Constitution, you'll find that it guarantees freedom of speech, free exercise of religion, and many other important liberties. But you won't read anything saying that we have a right to kill children in the womb. But if the court in Roe versus Wade twisted the Constitution, it took this amazing document that is widely revered for its protection of life and liberty and said that it actually guarantees a right to kill unborn babies. 1992, so nearly 30 years ago, was the last time that the Supreme Court heard a case where it directly confronted whether to keep or to discard Roe versus Wade. And it chose to keep what it called Roe's essential holding, that abortion cannot be stopped before a child is sufficiently developed to live outside the womb. So for the past five decades, states that have wanted to protect children in the womb have felt that their hands were tied by the Supreme Court's incorrect interpretation of the Constitution. Now, states have been able to do some helpful things on the margins, and those were important steps and sometimes led to abortion-related cases going before the Supreme Court. The cases that the Supreme Court has heard in recent years have been about regulations regarding who can perform abortions, where they can be performed, and how they can be performed. For instance, a state may say that an abortion provider needs to have admitting privileges to a nearby hospital. And sometimes when states pass laws like these, abortionists challenge them in court, and then the courts look at whether the regulations create an undue burden on a woman's ability to access abortion services. But even if the court allows the regulations to stay in place, abortion is still allowed. It just have to be done in accordance with the regulations. And that's what sets the current Supreme Court case apart from the cases of more recent memory. This case, the Dobbs case, is about a state's ability to stop abortions, not just regulate the way in which they're performed. The state of Mississippi chose to protect unborn children from abortion at and after 15 weeks gestation with very limited exceptions. That directly conflicts with the Supreme Court's Roe versus Wade decision and subsequent decisions of the Supreme Court, which say that the government cannot prohibit abortion before viability, that is, before a child is sufficiently developed to live outside his or her mother's womb. And in the Dobbs case, everyone on both sides of the case agree that a child at 15 weeks gestation cannot survive outside the womb. So, unsurprisingly, a Mississippi abortion provider challenged Mississippi's law and won in the lower courts. But now the Supreme Court has agreed to hear the case. And that's significant because the Supreme Court agrees to hear arguments in fewer than 100 cases per year, even though they're asked to review thousands of cases each year. Now, I know that the people on this call may be disappointed to hear that the challenged Mississippi law only protects children once they hit the age of 15 weeks gestation. Hopefully, all of you want protection from when life begins, the point of conception. So I just want to encourage you all by saying this. The state of Mississippi has directly asked the Supreme Court to reject Roe versus Wade entirely. Of course, the Supreme Court doesn't have to do that, but if it does, states should then be able to protect life from the very beginning. And that's a key reason why this case is so important. Finally, the Supreme Court is squarely confronting its decision in Roe versus Wade and deciding whether to maintain or reject it. And we need Christians to pray that the justices rule for life. So I implore every person listening to intercede for a just result in this case. Now, as I said, if the Supreme Court rejects Roe versus Wade, as the state of Mississippi has requested, then states will once again be able to step up and do what is right. We can expect some states to do so immediately. In fact, Mississippi is one of a number of states that has what is called a trigger law on the books. And a trigger law is a law that will protect children in the womb from conception that's designed to be triggered into effect when Roe versus Wade is overruled. Now, other states, like my home state of California, can be expected to maintain abortion until there is a cultural shift. And that brings me to my second topic of the evening, which is the importance of the church and Christians proclaiming the sanctity of life. We need to be a nation that protects life. And if we are going to see that happen, I believe that we need the church to rise up to proclaim the truth about life and defend life. That has always been important, but the impact of an active church can be even greater if Roe versus Wade is overturned and people are once again making decisions about whether their state will protect life. Sadly, much of the body of Christ has been silent on this critical issue. And that is tragic because We are supposed to be salt and light in the world. The silence is even more devastating to me when I consider that abortion is not just a problem in the culture at large that the church should be remedying through outreach. It's a problem in the church itself. Studies show that many women who have abortions identify as Christians. Many women who get abortions are also churchgoers, and many churchgoers wrongly believe that the Bible is unclear regarding whether or not abortion is morally acceptable. While this grieves my heart, it really doesn't surprise me. Our culture has done a fantastic job convincing people that abortion is just fine. And when the culture tells lies and the church stays silent about the truth, we really should not be surprised when churchgoers believe the lies. So if you're a pastor listening today, I urge you to preach a full sermon about the sanctity of human life in the womb. And if you're not a pastor, I urge you to encourage your pastor to teach about the sanctity of life. But don't just pass the responsibility on to your pastor. Look for opportunities in your own spheres of influence to spread the truth about God's precious gift of life that begins at conception. Now, I understand that many pastors are hesitant to talk about abortion. They are worried that it is too controversial or that it will seem political. But while it is indeed political and controversial, it is first and foremost a biblical issue. And as a shepherd of the flock, pastors have a responsibility to speak the truth and protect their flock from being led astray to the slaughter, the literal slaughter of their own children. I think another matter that makes pastors hesitate to address abortion is the very sad reality that abortion has touched many in the church. There are women in the church who have had abortions. There are women and men in the church who have encouraged or even forced women to have abortions. But those are actually reasons to address the subject, not reasons to avoid it. There are people sitting in church pews every Sunday, riddled with guilt and shame about their participation in an abortion. Imagine the healing they could experience if pastors spoke about abortion in a way that is loving and truth-filled. Pastors can use the opportunity to remind their congregation that we do serve a forgiving God. It can proclaim the liberating truth that God is ready to cleanse us of any sin that we have fallen into, whether abortion or something else. Pastors can assure their congregation that they can find healing, wholeness, and restoration by the grace of God, and it can be used by God in powerful ways. So preaching about life in the proper way can set people free of the guilt and shame that plagues them, and spare other people from walking down that path of death and destruction. You know, everyone on the call tonight knows that the devil seeks to kill, steal, and destroy. And he has used abortion to accomplish these aims. Since Roe versus Wade, it is estimated that abortion has claimed the lives of over 62 million children in America alone. Now, when I hear a number like that, it's hard to comprehend, but just to try to put it in perspective, if we wanted to take 5 seconds of silence to honor each of those lives that we have lost, you'd need to remain silent for nearly 10 entire years. Now, you may ask, how have we come to this point? Well, there are many factors, but a critical one is the relative silence of the church. In Ezekiel 33, the Lord talks about watchmen. He said that if a watchman sees the sword coming upon the land and blows a trumpet of warning, then those who suffer after ignoring the warning are responsible for their own fate. But if the watchman sees the sword coming and does not sound the trumpet of warning, the blood of the victims is on the head of the watchman. Now, we can debate about whether this passage applies to this context, but let me just offer this exhortation to Christian leaders. You know that society is telling Christians that abortion is acceptable. And you now know that Christians are buying that lie and turning to abortion. How tragic will it be if a woman in your church hires someone to kill her own child in the womb simply because she never heard the truth from you? How terrible will it be if parents in your church pressure their teenage daughter to have an abortion because they think that's better than the church knowing that she fell into sexual sin? So I truly implore you to rise up, share what the Bible says about the sanctity of human life in the womb, and help Christians understand what abortion really is. The killing of innocent children who are made in the image of God and are precious in God's sight. And help your congregation and your friends and family know that you stand ready to love and forgive if someone falls into sexual sin or if they have had or participated in an abortion. Now, I realize that proclaiming the truth about the sanctity of life and abortion can be tough. It can be scary, but God calls us to be strong and courageous. So please be courageous enough to speak up. As it says in Proverbs 31, verse 8, open your mouth for the speechless in the cause of all who are appointed to die. Now, I don't have time to give a full sermon about why God hates abortion, but I'll give you a few highlights from the Bible to help equip you to share with your Christian friends, your pastor, and your congregation if you are a pastor. Most Christians understand that humans are made in the image of God and that murder is wrong. Where confusion tends to arise is whether children in the womb are somehow in a separate category. Thankfully, the Bible does not leave us guessing. It demonstrates that God values children in the womb just like he values each person watching today. Now, there are a number of scripture verses that establish this point, and I'll share two of my favorites with you. The first is found in the first chapter of Luke, and there we read about Mary. While pregnant with Jesus, she goes to visit her relative Elizabeth, who is pregnant with John the Baptist. So we're about to have a meeting of four people, two women and the two boys they are carrying inside them. And something truly amazing happens. When Elizabeth heard Mary's greeting, John the Baptist, quote, leaped for joy in Elizabeth's womb. And not only did John leap for joy while in the womb, but we also know from Luke 1 that John was filled with the Holy Spirit even before his birth. Now, how can you explain that if you think unborn children are meaningless, disposable blobs of cells like the culture tells us? You simply can't. Second biblical illustration I want to share comes from the Old Testament. And I hope that everyone remembers Samson, the supernaturally strong man with long hair. Well, he had long hair because he was a Nazirite, a person consecrated to God who observes certain dietary restrictions and a prohibition on hair cutting. So when did Samson become a Nazirite? It was actually while he was still an unborn baby. Indeed, Judges chapter 13 tells us that an angel came to Samson's mother and told her not to eat or drink certain things while she was pregnant because Samson was supposed to be a Nazirite to God from the womb. So Samson in the womb was a person, the same person he was outside the womb. And if that were not the case, God would not have cared about Samson observing the dietary restrictions of a Nazirite even before he was born. This passage from Judges creates a serious problem for the "my body, my choice" mantra that we so often hear from those who support abortion. Here, God is making clear that when a woman is pregnant with one child, two bodies are involved, the body of the mother and the body of the baby. So when a woman has an abortion, she's not just making a decision about her body, she is making a decision that ends the life of her child. As followers of Christ, we must work to stop this evil. So as I wrap up, I want to summarize and emphasize a few things and share some specific prayer requests with all of you faithful prayer warriors. First, the case now before the U.S. Supreme Court, Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, is not just another abortion case. I was around 7 years old when I first decided to work toward ending abortion in America. This is the first time since then that the court has agreed to hear a case that poses a direct challenge to Roe versus Wade. This is a moment that people in the pro-life movement have been awaiting decade after decade. And in those intervening decades, sadly, millions and millions of children have met a violent death in the name of so-called constitutional rights. Thomas Jefferson once wrote, "I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just and his justice cannot sleep forever. I don't even want to think about how terrible it will be if we do not see a victory for life and justice in the Dobbs case. So please pray that God will have mercy and grant a tremendous victory for life in that case. The stakes are incredibly high. Millions of lives are on the line. Indeed, I would say that the very fate of our nation may hang in the balance. So on that front, here are a few specific matters I urge you to cover in prayer. As Pastor Garlow said at the outset, oral arguments are scheduled for December 1st. So mark your calendar for December 1st, but don't just pray on that day. Pray leading up to it and pray following it, because then the justices will be working on their decision for months after the argument, most likely. So the Mississippi Solicitor General will argue the pro-life position on December 1st, and preparing for that is going to be a grueling task for him and his team to prepare. It's not just giving a speech. It's trying to prepare for every single question any of the nine justices may throw at him. So please consider praying and fasting for them as they prepare to plead for the lives of unborn children, just as the Jewish people prayed and fasted for Queen Esther before she went before the king to plead for the lives of her people. Please also pray for the justices of the United States Supreme Court. They have excellent legal arguments before them showing why they should rule for life, but ruling for life requires courage. They face enormous pressure to maintain Roe versus Wade, and that pressure will likely intensify in the coming months. So please pray that the justices will have the courage and resolve to rule for life, and that they would be instruments of justice in this case. And please pray that the enemy will not succeed in attacking those who will uphold justice. Remember, this may be at the United States Supreme Court, but this is more than just a legal issue. As Ephesians says, we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. So your intercessions are critical. Beyond the Supreme Court, please pray that God will forgive our nation for its bloodshed and transform us to be a nation that values and protects God's amazing gift of human life. Please pray that pastors and Christian schools and Christian ministries and each individual follower of Christ will courageously and lovingly shine God's light in the darkness to expose the evil of abortion. Pray that mothers, fathers, and the broader family will see each child in the womb as a precious gift from God who should be welcomed with love and with joy. To aid you in speaking about life, you can find a sample pro-life sermon on Reason for Life's website, which is simply reasonforlife.org. And if you ever want me to speak about the sanctity of life at your church or Christian school or college or some Christian event, please feel free to reach out to me. You can find Reason for Life's contact information online at reasonforlife.org. And now, in conclusion, just hearkening back to the book of Esther, I do believe that each of you are alive today for such a time as this. So I urge you, with everything that is in me, to let your cries for justice be heard by God and by man. Go forth and proclaim the truth that God's precious gift of life begins at the moment of conception. Thank you for listening. Thank you for praying. May God bless you all as you seek to preserve and protect God's precious creation, made in his own image, human beings whose lives begin at conception. Thank you.
Oh, that was excellent, Samuel. My goodness, what a thorough presentation. I was intrigued. At 7 years of age, did I hear you right? The Lord spoke
to you. That's correct.
Take 30 seconds and unpack that one. Your first name is Samuel, and you were spoken to as a child, like the biblical Samuel. Help us understand what happened at seven.
Well, I can't say that I heard the voice of God directly, but I learned about what abortion is, and it broke my heart. You know, I was blessed knowing that I had parents who would give their life to protect me. And when I found that there are children being killed for the sake of convenience, my tender heart was shattered. And I believe that it was at that time that it was God who was placing a burden on my heart to work toward ending abortion. And from that time, it has been my driving force in life to work toward ending abortion. When I was seven, my plan was relatively simple, and I was going to become president. I was going to end abortion by executive fiat. When I was around 9 years old, I realized, hey, not a lot of people become president. I should think of a backup plan. And that was when I decided to go to law school so that I could fight for children in the courtroom if the whole president thing didn't work out. And I've been just pursuing the cause of life ever since.
Wow. Let's don't give up on the president thing quite yet. Okay. you reference pastors. You're not talking probably to a lot of pastors. Most of the people on are not pastors, but let me say all lay persons are listening. You just were equipped. If you're not pastoring a church, makes no difference. Everything he said applies to you in your conversation on Facebook. And okay, fasten your seatbelts, folks. This is a no nonsense kind of ministry. If your pastor will not speak out on abortion, find a new pastor. We all on the same page? Don't continue to support somebody who will not support babies being dismembered in the womb, torn to shreds with no anesthesia. I hardly ever use the word abortion. I talk about babies killed in the womb, dismembered in the womb. We're inoculated. We hear the word of abortion. I talked to one candidate who sort of said he was sort of pro-abortion. I said, really? Sit down here. I have a computer. We're going to watch an abortion together. You're going to watch what you support. He didn't want to watch what he supported. And no human being would tolerate that at all. So equip yourselves. This is Samuel has given a very, very thorough understanding of equipping. Samuel, give the website again how they can reach out to you, first of all, to find all the material you have. But secondly, he offered himself to speak in locations. And he's considerably younger than the average demographic, perhaps even on this call. That being the case, take advantage of him to be available to come to your church or your community or whatever. Samuel, tell us the website and how can they reach you if they want you to come speak on this?
Yes, the website is simply reasonforlife.org. That's reasonforlife.org. And the contact information is there, but you can also send an email to info@reasonforlife.org.
Very good. If I'm going to make a statement, then you give commentary on this. The statement is this: what the Supreme Court decides is not the law of the land. The law of the land is the Constitution of the United States. Not what a Supreme Court says. Comment, please.
Yes. So the Constitution is our supreme law. The practical reality of how things work today is that when the Supreme Court issues a pronunciation of what the Constitution supposedly means, then the lower courts fall in line, and that has a direct impact on what the states feel they're able to do. So we've seen states step out, for example, and pass laws stopping the killing of children in the womb once they have a heartbeat or things like that. But before those laws even go into effect, with the exception of the recent Texas situation, those courts strike them down immediately because of what the Supreme Court said in Roe versus Wade. So even the most pro-life federal judge, when they're at these lower court levels, they feel that it is their duty to apply the Supreme Court precedent, even if it's wrong. And so that's sadly how things happen in practice. And so these judges on the lower courts will often write separate decisions explaining how wrong the Supreme Court was in Roe versus Wade and urging the Supreme Court to readdress the issue and correct their tragic mistake. But then they go ahead and rule consistent with Roe. And so that's why this Dobbs case is really so critical, because for almost 50 years, states have been unable to do very much to protect life. They've been doing what they can within the confines of Roe versus Wade, but their hands have been tied. So I'm praying for a great victory in Dobbs so that they can be free to do their duty to stand for life again, because Roe was a tragic injustice, an act of basically the court just legislating from the bench, not faithfully applying the Constitution.
Samuel, this next question, I want to give you the right to say, I'll bypass on that. You don't have to answer this one. This pertains to the Mississippi Attorney General. I don't know what his name is. You would know him, probably may even know him personally. I don't know. This is the first time in 48 years we've had a viable case. We've waited almost a half century for this moment. I do not know him, and I'm going to take the velvet off the brick and ask the question this way. Is this a person who's up for the game for this? And if you want to bypass, I'll go to the next question. I'll let you off the hook easy.
Well, I will say this. The Mississippi Solicitor General is a very smart man. His name is Scott Stewart. He clerked for a federal judge. He has argued many appellate cases. He is new to the job as Mississippi Solicitor General. He actually started this year, and shortly after he started, all of a sudden this gigantic case falls in his lap with the Supreme Court granting it. The state of Mississippi had asked the court to hear it last year before Scott Stewart was working for Mississippi. But this would be a tremendous challenge for any lawyer, whether they've argued before the Supreme Court more times than they can count, or never argue before the Supreme Court. So I'm sure that your prayers would be well spent in praying for the Mississippi Solicitor General and his team to have wisdom as they prepare a reply brief that is responding to the arguments of the other side and the many friend of the court briefs from abortion supporters, and that you pray for them as they prepare for this oral argument. I was very happy to see that their main merits brief to the Supreme Court argued with zeal for Roe versus Wade to be overturned in its entirety. There were some who thought, you know, the state may try to go a middle road and say, look, you know, we're just trying to protect life in these later stages and focus on that. But to their credit, they went forth with gusto and said, Roe versus Wade was wrong. It needs to go entirely. States need to be free to protect life.
Well, you encourage me, because I sometimes somebody will argue for a case and they're generally in favor of it, but they're not visceral about it. So that gives me great comfort what you have just stated. Now, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but when a case comes before the Supreme Court, the attorneys on both sides really only have a total of about 1 hour to present. The case is only there for 1 hour with 9 justices who interrupt constantly. With the exception of Justice Thomas, we had the privilege of being with him on 2 occasions. My wife and I had a private lunch with he and Jenny at one time, his wife Jenny, and I said, "Sir, why do you not talk on the Supreme Court?" He's hardly spoken in all the years he's been on. why do you not talk? And he said, because all the people who are there, they've read all the briefs, they've made up their minds. It's all theater. They don't need to talk. They didn't used to in the old days. And it's grandstanding and they constantly interrupt. It's staggering to me how an attorney before the Supreme Court, nine of them there, eight of whom are interrupting almost constantly. You can hardly get through a sentence and you need at least four or five sentences to develop a thought and make a case. You can't even get through one. So am I correct that the total time they have before the Supreme Court for both sides, is it 1 hour or am I wrong that they have longer than that? And then we've got to pray that they'll let the Solicitor General of Mississippi actually make his case. Your comments?
Generally, most cases that go before the Supreme Court do have an hour, 30 minutes for each side. In this case, I think the United States is asking to have argument time also in support of the abortion providers, unsurprisingly. I think in their motion, they were asking for some extra time to be granted for that. So I'm not sure what the total time will end up being, but it's likely that the Mississippi Solicitor General will have about 30 minutes to argue. And it is very challenging. Remember, I said, it's not just giving a speech. It's trying to prepare for anything that may come at you. Now, this may surprise everyone listening because most of us don't want to be interrupted, but a lot of appellate advocates look forward to being interrupted because they've made their case in the briefs. And this is an opportunity for them to find out what are the justices struggling with that I can try to address head on rather than just giving a monologue. But it is difficult when you don't even have a chance to address what the justice is struggling with because 1.5 sentences into your answer, you're asked a question by another justice. So yes, prayers for wisdom to be able to answer those questions in real time in the most succinct, effective way that will penetrate the hearts of these justices are a good way to target your prayers.
So it's possible from what you're saying that the time scales could be tipped in the sense that 30 minutes for pro-life, 30 minutes for killing babies in the womb, and then the Biden administration is going to demand time for also making the case why we ought to keep killing babies. Is that correct?
Yes, they're asking for some additional time. And my understanding is that Mississippi is not objecting to the United States participating in argument, but is objecting to the idea that the United States and the abortion providers combined would have more time than Mississippi does. So I have yet to see a ruling on the court, but this has all happened in the last couple of days, and I can't say that I've been checking every few minutes. So maybe there's updated news on that, but I think that is yet to be resolved by the Supreme Court and how the argument breakdown will occur.
You filed a friend of the court brief. Tell people what that is and how many others approximately do you think have or will file friend of the court briefs, and to what extent do those have influence in the process?
Well, it's a great debate among lawyers what impact friend of the court briefs have. So normally in a case, you have the two main parties that are going at it and they file the principal briefs. But at the Supreme Court level, the way the court decides the case has an impact on the entire country. And so it's general practice for interested groups to be able to file what's called an amicus brief or friend of the court brief that's giving their perspective to the court, often on a unique area. So the state of Mississippi and the abortion providers, they have word limits or page limits that limit what they can say. So they try to present their best argument, and then there might be a brief that devotes an entire brief to a subject that took up two paragraphs in one of the party's main briefs. It does a deeper dive. And so in that respect, it can be helpful to the justices to be able to find additional sources or additional evidence on a particular point that may not have been able to be fleshed out fully by the parties. And so that can be valuable. But, you know, in this case, given its significance, there have been many amicus briefs filed. I think that on the pro-life side, I want to say it was somewhere around 70 briefs, but don't quote me on that. And I didn't count the number on the pro-abortion side, but it was a very significant number as well.
who reads those? It's just the clerks, people clerking for the justices as opposed to the justices themselves?
I think it probably really depends from chambers to chambers. I'd be surprised if I heard that any single justice read every single brief in the cases. But, you know, one of the things that clerks do is write memos for the justices they're working for, and they can highlight certain things that they think deserve the justice's closer attention. And then once the case is argued and the justices conference, they're going to find out who's winning. And then whoever the most senior judge is on the winning side will assign an opinion, or assign a justice to write the opinion. And so whichever justice is assigned the opinion, I'm sure that he or she and their clerks are going to be taking even closer look at the briefs than the other justices.
After a case is heard, all nine justices actually, I know they don't write it and release it till June, but they release all of them. Do all of them actually come into a same room and cast a vote per se, or is that done simply by writing? And how long after the case does that vote take place?
Well, they all go into a room and it's incredibly confidential. Not even the justice's clerks are allowed in the room. And the most junior justice is actually assigned as the door opener. So if anyone knocks, the most junior justice has to go get the door. Just a little bit of Supreme Court trivia for you. But they meet around a table and they hash it out of it and see where the justices land and who's on the winning side. And then there are typically multiple iterations of an opinion circulated. And then, you know, on the losing side, there's going to be a justice or perhaps multiple justices writing a dissenting opinion. And so they'll circulate the drafts of that. And then the judge with the majority opinion may modify the opinion to address the attacks and the dissenting opinion. So it's an ongoing process that can take a while. And in the case of this magnitude, I would expect the opinion to come probably in June, but it could come earlier.
I believe that not just five, but I think six of the justices have at some time ruled in favor of some pro-life issue. But I know this is the kind of question no attorney likes, but what is your sensing? I've been profoundly disappointed with everybody except Justice Thomas and Justice Alito. The others have been I've been quite shocked. And Amy Coney Barrett, I've just been very disappointed at a lot. Gorsuch, it's been a challenge. What is your sensing on where we are on this?
Well, you correctly recognize that attorneys don't like that kind of a question. And I hate making predictions. I don't know what's going to happen. God knows, and I don't think any other attorney does. But I am cautiously optimistic in this case. To prevail in the case, we need five justices to be on the side of life. I mentioned in my presentation that the court accepts argument in less than 100 cases each year out of the many thousands of cases it's asked to hear. And to hear a case, it requires four justices to agree to hear it. So one shy of the winning number. And so what we're seeing is, well, presumably there's at least four justices that want to take a look at Roe versus Wade, because I wouldn't think the pro-abortion justices have any interest in hearing the case. The case is not heard. You know, Roe stands and is not called into question. And my hope is that the four justices who agreed to take the case think that they have a fifth vote. And so I hope that they're right. And I hope that, you know, the pressure that I said will be intensifying doesn't end up changing things in a problematic way. All of the, at least I think six of the justices, their judicial philosophy should lead them to rule for life. Roe versus Wade invented a right to abortion out of thin air. It's not based in the Constitution, and all of them know that. And so their inclination, I think, will be to rule for life. The question is whether they're going to be willing to do that in in the face of pressure, in the face of threats of court packing. And, you know, my hope is that these justices will take advantage of their lifetime appointments, which is designed to insulate from political pressure and rule in accordance with what the Constitution says, which will lead to a ruling for life.
We won't take off on this issue, but they used the word penumbra and simply said created this shadow. They said there's a shadow. There wasn't anything in the Constitution supporting abortion. So they went by their penumbra or shadow. That is the word that they used. Do we know who the four justices are, or were there only four, or were there more that ruled that said they want to hear this? Do we know who they are at all?
That's a good clarifying question. We do not know and won't know who they are. And it could have been five or even six who agreed to take it, but we know that there were at least four.
Samuel, you've done a phenomenal job for us. I'm so appreciative.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Please read the show notes for additional details if you would like a copy of the book or resources mentioned. Remember that Well-Versed is a 501c3 tax-deductible nonprofit organization. We rely on your support and partnership.
Thank you for listening to the Well-Versed podcast. For more information, please go to www.wellversedworld.org.